Well, this morning, before we continue, I have a story to share with you. It's a story about what happened last night. some of y'all were there. I know you were. Last night, Unite happened, and Unite was this worship and prayer event where students and some staff from North Central and Crown and Bethel and Northwestern got together, and we just shared this this beautiful time of worship together and of prayer, and it was just all under the banner of Jesus, and we got to make much of his name last night. And I just want to share that with you, the community here this morning, and just let you know that that Northwestern has been prayed for. Our presidents all were there. Our presidents and their spouses were all there in attendance, and we prayed for them together. It was fantastic, and I just wanted you to know that happened. And the Spirit is really on the move, you guys. And it was evident last night, and it was just a fantastic time. So for those of you who made it out to Bethel last night for that, thanks for coming, and praise be to God. Our speaker this morning is Dr. Brandon J. O'Brien. He is the Senior Director for Content Development and Distribution, which basically means he oversees the publishing efforts of Redeemer City to City in New York City. City to City supports gospel movements in global cities. Brandon's team serves this vision by finding, cultivating, and platforming Christian thought leaders from around the world. Brandon has worked in Christian publishing, Christian academia, and local church ministry for more than 20 years. He's the author of several books about culture and Bible reading, including the book Misreading Scripture Through Western Eyes, co-authored with Randy Richards. Brandon and his wife are coming. Brandon's here with us from Chicago area, where he lives with his wife and his two kids. And so I want you to know he's here with us today. He's here with us in chapel again on Wednesday. So would you please give a nice warm welcome to Dr. Brandon J. O'Brien.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Well, good morning, everybody. That was really bad. Good morning, everybody. Thank you. I need a lot of encouragement. I grew up Southern Baptist on one side and Pentecostal on the other, so if the room is not talking, it's a bad sign. So thank you for talking back to me. I now work with Presbyterians. It's really kind of confusing. Thank you to Darren for the invitation to be here with you guys. It's a real honor to be at your university. It's also special to me to be in Minnesota, because I haven't spent a lot of time here, but I have some sort of spiritual connections that mean a lot to me. My grandma grew up in White Bear Lake, which I think is near here. Any White Bear Lake people? Yeah? Oh, look, one right there. Okay. My grandma was the most prayerful person I've ever met. She died a few years ago, but I always had the image that when my grandma prayed, there was like a special phone in God's office that lit up, and he was like, excuse me, everyone, this is Diana, I have to take this, right? So sometimes when I felt like my prayers weren't being answered, I consoled myself in thinking, well, probably grandma's got the line tied up. So my grandma is a special person, really important to my spiritual life, and it was actually not far from here that I received my initial call to ministry while visiting St. Olaf College, which is not far, I think. And I'll say more about that in a little bit, but it's the only time in my life that I recall hearing anything like an audible voice from God. And as I was reflecting on our time together today, I was kind of reminded of that experience and reminded it happened near here. And so being here is kind of like a pilgrimage. It's kind of special to be back into a place that has some spiritual significance. So what I want to talk about this morning with you is calling. This is a topic that created a lot of anxiety for me for a lot of years. And I think I can honestly say that it's only been in the last few that I have felt some sort of confidence in my sense of calling and understanding what that is and what it means. And what it means for me to be joining in God's mission in Christ's kingdom on earth. So I want you to know that the topic for today comes to you after having lost a lot of sleep, probably a lot of hair over the topic of sort of wrestling with my sense of calling. For those of you who like to know where we're going before we get there, and in case I forget to land the plane at some point, the main topics, the main takeaway for today is this. Your calling may be a moving target. And if you will worry less about the details of your calling and more about following Jesus, everything will be just fine. That's sort of the headline version. And we're going to look at two passages of scripture. One is in Mark 1. So if you have a device and want to flag that, you can, or stick a note in the pages. The other passage will be Jeremiah 16. So Mark 1, Jeremiah 16. All right. When Jesus called his first four disciples, all four of them were fishermen. And they were all busy doing what fishermen do at the time when he called them. They were in their boats. They were doing their work. They were mending their nets. Peter and Andrew and James and John. And in Mark 1, Jesus walks up to them while they're doing their work, and he says, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." This is Mark 1, 17. And immediately, Mark says, off they go. Jesus says, "Follow," they drop everything and they follow him. The story reads exactly the same in Matthew, and it's a little bit different in Luke, but the punchline is the same. In all three accounts, Jesus tells these fishermen that your job is about to change, and he uses the same metaphor. You're going to stop fishing for fish, and you're going to start fishing for people. And when he says that, they leave their boats and their nets and their fathers and their servants, everything. And they do it all at once, and they follow Jesus. There's something about that phrase, "I will make you fishers of men," that sort of triggered in their imagination that now it's go time. What I find really interesting about this is it's unique among all the calls of all the disciples. Jesus doesn't later tell Levi the tax collector, "From now on, you will no longer collect taxes, you will collect people." He doesn't say it to anybody else. He only says it to these fishermen. "From now on, you will catch people." And that was the sort of moment that they felt like something had shifted. I had a similar kind of fishers of men experience, as I mentioned before, not far from here at St. Olaf College when I was 17. This happened in a time period my children refer to as the late 1900s, which makes me feel much older than I am. But my high school choir went to St. Olaf. I grew up in Arkansas. We made a long drive up here to attend kind of a webinar with the wonderful choral director, Anton Armstrong. And our choir came. We were top rated in the state of Arkansas, which I recognize now means very little. But we felt pretty good about it. And we got there prepared to sing our song. We sang in front of the St. Olaf choir. They clapped politely. And then Dr. Armstrong handed them some sheet music of the same song, which they sang back to us and nearly blew our faces off with just a wall of sound that I did not know could come from people. And so it was a really incredible, as humbling experience. But after they sang to us, Dr. Armstrong kind of put us in a circle and we sang in a round, and he stood in the middle and he had us sing a song that we had prepared. We sang the song, "God's Gonna Set This World on Fire" by Moses Hogan, which is a really cool song. And he sort of stood in the middle of us, and he does what choral and orchestral directors do, which is pretty cool, is he like drew things out of us with his hands, which I always think is kind of like sorcery, right? So he pointed at somebody and got more sound out, and he pointed at somebody else and took a little less sound. And he kind of worked around the circle doing this, trying to get us to improve our volume and improve our vowels or whatever. And as he made his way around the circle, he looked at me and he said, "God gave you a message to share with the world." And I know, and you know, and everybody in that circle knows that what he was talking about is, "I need you to sing your guts out," right? "I need you to say this like you mean it." But what I felt in the moment was that God was speaking to me through that choral director who had never met me and telling me something that I had been hesitant to hear, which is, "I've got something that I want you to do." I felt that in that moment like I had a calling. Maybe you've had an experience like that, a sort of fishers of men moment where before then you had sort of one set of plans and then after that you felt like everything had shifted. When Anton Armstrong looked at me and said, "God gave you a message to share with the world," I felt in my bones, it's time. It's go time. It's time to do something different. And I was sure in that moment, without any additional reflection, that the thing that I was supposed to do was to be a preacher. I don't know if anybody uses that word anymore, but I was Southern Baptist in a small town, so there's still preachers in small towns. I was going to be a preacher. And there's a reason my mind went straight to preacher and not something else. And the reason is, for all of us, whenever you sense a calling, whenever you feel God put something on your heart to do, your sense of what that calling is will always be shaped by your own imagination, will always be shaped by your sense of what's possible. And for me, in the circle of friends I had in the home church and the social environment that I had, there were not a lot of options in my imagination for what it meant to be called to ministry. I knew you could be a missionary, but I don't think that honestly even entered my mind at the time. I knew you could be a youth pastor, but I didn't even like youth group as a youth person, so I thought, that's not the one. You might think, because I was called at a choir event, that maybe I would be a music person, but I was the only person in the choir who couldn't read music, and I still can't, but don't tell my teacher. I just faked it. I sat close to someone and followed along. And I thought that I probably shouldn't then be the one waving his hand at the front. And so really what that left for me was pastor, not youth pastor, not music pastor, but pastor. And when I talked to my church about it and talked to the deacons and talked to my friends, they all affirmed the same thing because they had kind of the same imagination for what being called to ministry could look like. And so my deacons at our church bought me a couple of suits to preach in. They bought me a gigantic pulpit Bible to preach from. And at 17, they were like, "Well, off you go. You are now, you know, whatever." We were Baptists. We didn't bless anybody. But you understand. They just kind of sent me off. They sent me off to go do the thing. And so I think when Jesus says to the disciples, "I will make you fishers of men," when they drop everything, they're ready to go, they're totally confident, just like I was, without any further reflection, that they knew exactly what it was that Jesus was asking them to do. Because their imaginations were limited in the same ways that yours and mine are, by their own experience and by their own sense of what's possible. But here's my question for us, is what is it that they thought they were supposed to do next? They dropped their nets because it's time to do the thing. What's the thing? What was it in their imagination when they heard, "I want to make you fishers of men"? Where did their mind go immediately? Now, if you were raised in a Christian environment like I was, and attend a Christian college, it may seem obvious to you that Jesus is talking about something like evangelism. I'm going to send you out to bring people in. But keep in mind that there were not yet in history any evangelists. Jesus had not died for anyone's sins yet, and he had not been raised from the dead. There was no good news to share. And you might say, well, maybe he was called to full-time vocational ministry. Well, there were Pharisees, and there were Sadducees, and there were scribes, but there was no church yet, because that doesn't start for another 10 years or so in the story. So they wouldn't have had any concept for evangelism, and they wouldn't have had any concept for full-time vocational ministry. So whatever it was that popped into their mind first when they heard this phrase, fishers of men, would be very different from what pops into my head and into your head when you hear that very same phrase. Are you with me? So the question is, what is it that they thought they were called to do? One way to answer that question is to say, what is it that fishermen, why do fishermen fish? Okay, this seems like a pretty basic question. Why do fishermen fish? Fishermen catch fish to eat them, or they catch fish to sell to other people to eat them, right? They don't go fishing to make new friends. They don't catch fish to befriend them. You might catch fish to make them your pets, But I don't think that was happening a lot in the ancient Near East. I don't think they had aquariums and water filtration and whatever else, right? So in their imaginations, their sense of what was possible, when they heard the phrase fishers of men, I think that where their imagination came from was the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible. And it turns out if you go looking for this phrase or something like it in the Old Testament, some things pop up. There's a lot of language in the Bible about people catching other people, about fishing and hunting and snaring and trapping. And I'm going to give you just a couple of examples. One of them is when Israel is in exile. Their experience is depicted as a hunting party among the nations. So in Ezekiel chapter 18, it says, "Then nations set against him, Israel, on every side from their provinces, and they spread their net over him. They captured him in their pit. They put him in a cage with hooks and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him in hunting nets so that his voice would be heard no more on the mountains of Israel." When people are out to get the psalmist, he describes the experience as being hunted or fished for. It says, "The proud have hidden a trap for me and cords. They have spread a net by the wayside. They have set snares for me." And then when God exacts judgment, the prophet describes it as catching men. "I will spread my net over him, and he will be caught in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon to enter into judgment with him there regarding the unfaithful act which he has committed against me." Okay, this is a lot to take early in the morning. I appreciate that, but just hang with me. Our second passage, Jeremiah 16, kind of brings all this together. Jeremiah describes really terrible conditions in Jerusalem. There's drought, there's famine, there's war, terrible things are happening. And then God says this. God says, "Now I will send for many fishermen, declares the Lord, and they will catch them. After that, I will send for many hunters, and they will hunt them down on every mountain and hill and from the crevices of the rocks. My eyes are on all their ways. They are not hidden from me, nor is their sin concealed from my eyes. I will repay them double for their wickedness and their sin, because they have defiled my land with the lifeless forms of their vile images and have filled my inheritance with their detestable idols." So what's the point? This is a really depressing list of verses. What's the point? The point is, I'm almost certain that in the imagination of the apostles, things like nets and hooks and snares, the tools of a fisherman, were considered tools of judgment. And I'm pretty sure that when they heard about catching people, whether God is doing it or people are doing it, that they imagined that that was an act of judgment. So my guess is that when the first four disciples who were fishermen heard Jesus say, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," the first thing they imagined is that God was calling them to join Jesus in the act of judging all the sinners in Israel. I think they imagined that they were being recruited to go out and bring judgment against their countrymen. And I imagine that the kind of image they got is there's a story in John 8 of a woman who's caught in adultery, and religious leaders bring her out in the street and they circle around her, and their plan is to cast stones and kill her with stones. And Jesus stops them. But I suspect the mental image the disciples got when Jesus said, "I'm going to make you fishers of men," is something like that scene, that now is our time. We're going to join God in the work of finding these evildoers and bringing them out for judgment. And so they drop their nets and they follow him. It's time to catch people. Let's do it. Let's go. And they're ready to go. They left with all the confidence that comes when you first receive a sense of calling. I had that same sense of confidence when I was 17 years old. I started preaching in nursing homes and to youth groups and in small churches in the area in my suit with the giant shoulder pads and my great big pulpit Bible. And I felt very confident that this was exactly what God wanted me to do forever. The decisions feel really clear and easy. Where should I go to college? What should I study? What should I do next? Because I have this sense of calling. Everything's clear. I know what to do. And I think the disciples felt exactly the same way. Everything's clear, everything's moving, let's go. And then what I love about this story is that Jesus takes them forward, and the very first things they do are totally surprising. Jesus starts preaching with authority. The crowds are amazed. Jesus casts out an evil spirit, and the crowds are amazed. Jesus heals people with diseases. He casts out demons. He cleanses lepers. And the people want more. There's no way the disciples had any imagination that this is the kind of stuff that we were going to do together. The good news for them is that all of this stuff is kind of awesome. And so the people really like Jesus, and they're hanging around with Jesus. So it's all upside as far as the apostles are concerned. But they may have been wondering, like, when do we get to the judging? Like, when does the actual work start? When does the calling kick in? This feels like maybe prep or something, but it's not the thing. So when do we get to the thing? I can imagine that for many of you, college feels like an important start of preparing for your calling, but that means a calling is kind of out there in the future somewhere. And right now you're just not doing it. And maybe you're getting antsy. Maybe you think the time you're spending here, or feels like the time you're spending here, is irrelevant or is distracting. I think that's a total normal way to feel. You're ready to get on with it. I think that the disciples probably felt similarly. This is all great, healing and preaching, casting out demons, fine. But when do we get started with the judgment? And then something in the story, the story takes a turn. After the calling, after the miracles, the very next thing Jesus does is he takes the disciples to dinner at the home of a tax collector named Levi. Maybe this felt like things were finally starting. Levi is a tax collector. A tax collector is a proper sinner, finally. We're interacting with sinners. Now's the time. Tax collectors, tax season is coming up soon. It may not affect all of you, but let me just say that I don't like tax collecting any more in the 21st century than anybody liked tax collecting in the first century. But the feeling is a little bit different, right? Because tax collectors at the time often were Israelites who spoke the local language and knew the local economy, but they worked for the Romans. And the way they made their living is they charged more than Rome charged for taxes, and they kept the extra. And so not only are they cheating their neighbors, but they're cheating their neighbors in a way that benefits the empire that's oppressing them. So it's just bad all around, and nobody likes them. And so I can imagine that the apostles think, finally, we're going to Levi's house. Levi is a sinner. It's time to let the judgment begin. But that's not what happens. Instead of judging Levi and his guests, the guests are not identified. They're just called sinners. It's a room full of sinners, Levi being the only one with a name. And instead of judging them, Jesus reclines at the table with them in fellowship. Jesus makes friends with sinners. Instead of exacting judgment, he breaks bread and brings peace. There is no way his disciples saw that coming. And the reason I know that is because the religious leaders who are standing nearby, and maybe they're standing outside and looking in the window, because I don't think they want to be in that room, is they say, "What? Why is your rabbi eating with sinners and tax collectors?" And the disciples can't even answer the question. You look this up in Mark 2. The Pharisees ask the disciples, but the disciples don't answer. It's Jesus who answers, because they don't know the answer. They have no idea why they're here. They're beginning to wonder, this calling felt really great not long ago, but help me remember the series of events that got me from that to this, which is not great. This is not what they signed up for. And I think for them, the target is moving. They felt a lot of clarity not long ago about what God was calling them to do, and now it all feels really unclear because the target has moved. What they thought they were called to do isn't happening. And right then, they realized that their calling didn't mean what they thought it meant. The clarity fades. With it, the enthusiasm fades. The support they had in the previous chapter, where everybody thinks it's awesome what Jesus is doing, they're preaching and people are amazed, and he's healing and people are amazed, and he's casting out demons and everybody wants more. After this story, all that enthusiasm turns into opposition. And suddenly the religious leaders are out to get them. And the disciples are kind of right here in the middle of it, getting questions that they don't know how to answer. And I think they're wondering, how did I get here? What in the world happened? Now listen, people's experiences of their calling can be very different. There is no one size fits all. Even in scripture, things happen differently. So sometimes in the Bible, God's directions are very clear and specific. God says to Ananias, go to the house of Judas on Straight Street and ask for a man from Tarsus named Saul. That's real clear direction. Sometimes God's directions are vague. God said to Saul, now get up and go into the city and then I will tell you what to do. Two very different experiences. Some people have a clear sense of calling, a single calling that lasts their whole life and they never have any questions about it. My college roommate was that way. He felt called to be an attorney. He went to school and became an attorney. He's still an attorney. As far as I know, he's never lost any sleep over it. My experience was different. I think my experience is that has been that God gives me a glimpse into the big picture and then sends me off and says, you will be told what to do. In the last 25 years, I've been a pastor, a professor, a publisher, and whatever it is I am now, someone who serves pastors through publishing and sometimes teaching. And so I resonate really deeply with the apostles because my understanding of my calling has been a moving target for years. So if that's you, you're in good company. You have good company in the Bible. You have good company in the room. Imagine even Father Abraham, who had many sons and was a really important figure. He says, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. He doesn't say what land. He just says, leave everything you know and go. It's 25 years from then until his first son Isaac is born. It's a long time for a moving target. Now, I realize there's a lot at stake when you think about your calling. The mental image I had when I was in high school and college, honestly, until pretty recently, was that our calling, life was a little bit like a conveyor belt where life is kind of moving along. And there's all these choices like school and who do I marry and where do I live and what's my job and all that kind of stuff. And my job was to get on the conveyor belt at the right time. And if I didn't get on the conveyor belt at the right time, now I'm living with God's second best for the rest of my life. I'm not in the job I'm supposed to be in or married to the person I'm supposed to be married to or whatever. And now the consequence is that I just live with this forever, right? Second best. And what that meant was that discerning my calling felt to me like a test of faith. Am I faithful enough to discern the calling? And then am I courageous enough to do it? It felt like it was all on me. And that God was kind of standing back with his arms crossed saying, good luck figuring this out. I felt that way for a long time. If you feel that way, let me give you some good news. If you experience your calling as a moving target, God is not testing your faith. He's expanding your imagination for what's possible. My imagination was limited at age 17 to what ministry meant. If God had told me then that you will be working with pastors all over the world, I would have said, I didn't even know there were pastors all over the world. I just thought there were missionaries that went to other parts of the world. I'd never even been on an airplane, so that wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense. If you had said I would write books and articles, I would say, look, outside of Calvin and Hobbes, I don't really even read anything. So that seems highly unlikely. If you had said I'd be partnering with seminaries and publishers, I would have told you I don't even really know what a seminary does, and outside of publishing Calvin and Hobbes, I don't know what a publisher does. So what God did in his kindness is called me in terms that I understood. He said, you've got something to share with the world, just go. Jesus spoke to the disciples in terms they would understand. He said, I'm going to make you fishers of men. If he had said, I'm going to make you friends with the lost sheep of Israel, they would have thought he was a sinner. If he said, in 10 years, I'm going to make you friends with Gentiles, they would have thought he'd lost his mind. If they said, you're going to be opposed by friends and family and all of Israel's religious leaders, and you're going to die a martyr's death, and you're going to feel good about it, they would have said, what on earth are you even talking about? So Jesus started with terms they would understand and then expanded their imagination for what was possible. The disciples' calling did not change, but They were never actually called to judgment. They were called to help Israel deal with its sin, and Jesus was going to show them there's a different way to do that. But come with me, and we'll figure it out. Some of you will feel called to teaching because you love working with children, and you might start teaching and then say, boy, I like kids, but I don't like teaching. That's okay. God's expanding your imagination. There's lots of ways to work with children. Some of you might go into medicine and start doing it and think, you know, I didn't think about the fact that I have to, like, deal with body parts. That's kind of gross. Well, there's lots of ways to heal people, and maybe God is expanding your imagination. Maybe you feel called to ministry and you do it a little bit and think, this is not for me. That's okay. God's expanding your imagination for what's possible. So I'll leave you with this because I'm about out of time. That Jesus said to these fishermen, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. And sometimes we put all the emphasis on the second half of that sentence. And we think of our calling as something we do for Jesus. But I think what the disciples got right is that they emphasized the first part of that sentence, follow me, and realized that their calling is something they do with Jesus. And as long as they're with Jesus, the details will change, but they're in great shape. Everything's going just as it should. In the next 10 years of their life, things are gonna go from bad to worse. Right now, eating with Levi is bad. Soon, Jesus is gonna say crazy things like, you gotta eat my body and drink my blood if you wanna hang out with me. They're gonna fellowship with eunuchs and centurions and sorcerers, things they never imagined doing because their calling was a moving target. But if I could give you one piece of advice, I would say this, like the disciples, your calling may be a moving target, but if you will worry less about the details of that calling and more about following Jesus, everything will be just fine. Thank you. And you're dismissed.